Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, News Director Rick Spezak. We've got an interesting show for you tonight. This is the first in a series of public service shows where we're doing a show tonight that's very special. Many of you are unaware of some of the details going on in Fukushima. And among the many organizations out there that is providing the facts on the Fukushima front is the Caldecott Foundation. And last week, they held a seminar that was broadcast over the web to inform people about what is actually going on and to put Fukushima in perspective. Unfortunately, as you know, the mainstream media basically is not covering it. And like so many important environmental stories, there's a blip. There's a flurry, then it disappears, and no one does the follow-up. Well, we're here to fix that tonight. We're going to play a series of excerpts of some of the presentations from the Caldecott Foundation seminar on Fukushima. And we'll be going into that in just a few minutes. I'm going to be joined by my guest host from Here Be Monsters, Miss Gwen Holden Berry. An incredible progressive activist in her own right, a fine progressive journalist, and in fact her show leads right into this one. There Be Monsters is on from 6 to 7, so she's collecting her notes and she'll be joining me in just a few minutes. So now, the news. As of February, Bank of America was servicing more than 95,000 loans in foreclosure. 95,000. And that's followed by Wells Fargo, which is servicing 85,000 loans. Now, none of the money that's supposed to go to the people who are underwater, who are trying to get their mortgages right, that money's not going out there. But boy, they are foreclosing. Also, another important story that we're following, Arne Gunderson from the Fair Winds, chief engineer, makes this statement. Since he's been talking about Fukushima, he got an email that brought him to tears. It was from a woman who was in 10th grade at the time of the Three Mile Island accident. She was in chemistry class, and they were studying radiation. And they had a Geiger counter hanging out the window for the entire semester so they could do ongoing measurements. They walked into the class at 10:30, the morning of the accident, and the Geiger counter's detector was pegged, which means it was off the scale. Radiation so high, the Geiger counter couldn't even record it. So the teacher goes to the phone as a responsible citizen. He calls the governor, Governor Thornburg, and tells him, look, I'm in Middleburg, and I've got a peg Geiger counter here. What should I do? So the governor, Governor of Pennsylvania Thornburg, his office told the high school teacher, don't do anything. We know all about it. So they kept the kids in the school who got evacuated were the parents of the people who worked at the power plant. They all came by, grabbed their kids, and got out of there. And the kids that didn't have the inside scoop wound up staying in the town and got very high exposures. So do I think my country's going to be any different than the Japanese? No way, he says. Another story called What me worry? President Obama wants to consign the financial crisis to the past and delegate the implementation of the financial reform to others in his administration. But he needs to get personally involved. Why? Because Senator Carl Levin's recent hearing on the J.P. Morgan whale showed that nothing has changed at the largest banks or the bank regulatory agencies since that run-up to the financial crisis. In the early months of 2012, 2 years after the passage of the Dodd-Frank Act, J.P. Morgan has acted deceptively, regulators have remained clueless, and investors were the last to know about the true magnitude of the bank's $6.2 billion in losses. Nevertheless, Republicans and some Democrats in Congress are today working to repeal the reforms. Yesterday, House Democrats joined House Republicans on the Agricultural Committee to support several bills that would, quote, fix, unquote, several Dodd-Frank provisions to regulate derivatives, effectively gutting the measures designed to rein in bank abuses. Proponents of deregulation, both Democrat and Republican, were hoping that these bills would move silently through the committee and then the Financial Services Committee, and then, quietly, in the dark of the night, onto the floor of the House for passage. Many Democrats, like Gwen Moore, Ann Kussler, David Scott, support or even co-sponsored these bills. Several others, most notably Goldman Sachs executive Jim Himes, who currently serves as the finance chairman for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, will help to lead the effort when these bills come to the House Financial Services Committee. Maybe you should weigh in. Senator Levin issued a statement Tuesday saying it's incredible that less than a week after their new J.P. Morgan whale hearings detailed how much the bank's London office piled up risk, hid losses, dodged regulatory oversight, that some House members are again supporting the weakening of derivative safeguards. One bill approved on a 31-14 vote moved some derivative trades to affiliates that have their own capital. The bill would allow banks, not their affiliates, to hold commodity, equity, and structured swaps tied to some asset-backed securities. You're putting the taxpayers on the hook, said Representative Colin Peterson of Minnesota, the panel's top Republican at the markup. This could come back to haunt you. Haunt you? Why, heavens, the taxpayers exist to bail out bankers, don't they? House Bill 7011. This from the Palm Beach Post Capitol Bureau. After a fierce debate Friday between ruling Republicans and union ally Democrats, the Florida House approved an overhaul of the Florida retirement system, the pension fund used by more than 620,000 teachers, law enforcement, and other public employees. The House voted 73-43 along party lines for the measure, House Bill HB 7011, which would close the traditional pension plan for new employees. Beginning January 1st, new hires seeking a retirement account would instead only join a defined contribution investment plan similar to 401k available to many private sector workers. This legislation is a top priority of House Speaker Will Weatherford and Republican of Wesley Chapel, who says the Florida retirement system is underfunded. Weatherford also maintains the system will command increasing millions of dollars from Florida taxpayers to keep it afloat, although his stance is disputed by many experts. It's fair, it's fiscally responsible, and it's time to act, Representative Rich Workman, a Republican of Melbourne, said, supporting the bill. Democrats, though, accuse House Republicans of employing scare tactics to push through a proposal that's being dismissed by Senate Republicans. During committee hearings, Democrats were supported by police and fire union representatives who packed the Capitol meeting rooms to testify against legislation. You're using boogeyman tactics of how the taxpayers will save money. It's absolutely false, Representative Dwayne Taylor of Daytona Beach told the House Friday. Democrats said the legislation is not only unnecessary but potentially dangerous to the $136 billion pension fund used by more than 623,000 state and local government officials and 335,000 retirees. The Florida retirement system is continuing 87% funded. Most analysts acknowledge that 80% funding is a benchmark for a fund considered to be on solid financial footing. Republican leaders, however, say the unfunded actuarial liability totals $19.2 billion, a level they say is alarming. And, of course, when Republicans are alarmed, oh, boy, there'll be hell to pay. And now, without any further ado, I will bring on my guest, host, the charming and talented Miss Gwen Holdenberry. Welcome, Gwen.
Hi, Rick. How are you today?
I'm very good, my dear. Very good. Boy, have we got a show tonight.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Get people woken up to what's going on.
You're another one of those individuals who's been following some of these environmental disasters that get so little press. I know you follow very closely ongoing troubles in the Gulf.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's not hard to do if you're paying attention. If you work at a desk, now if you don't work at a desk or you don't have time to spend at a desk every day, it's pretty difficult for people to really be aware. It finally dawned on me. You know, you really have to make that your way over to technology to grab the actual skinny on what's going on. But there is another way. Other folks manage to do it with wonderful smartphones, you know?
Indeed, indeed. The first little clip I want to play is from our good Democrat, great progressive, Mark Pafford, his comments on that that bill to gut the pension system. Here he is. Let me play this clip. This is Mark Pafford, solid progressive Democrat in the Florida House.
Over at the Village Inn, and there was a woman there by the name of Samantha, and Samantha was closing her section of the restaurant. She saw me, my tie was loosened, still wearing my jacket, I had my member pin, and she said, "Are you a legislator?" And I said, "Yes, I am a legislator." And she says, "I'd like to talk to you." And we spent about 30 minutes talking. She immediately told me that her job as a server at the Village Inn supplemented her state job that she's been in for 26 years. She went on to tell me that she was concerned. Why? Well, let me tell you about Samantha. She's divorced. She has a four-year degree from FSU, 1985, in risk management and insurance. Not only did she work at the Village Inn, she works at the Civic Center when she can get an opportunity to work. And she also works for the Florida Department of Financial Services. She's a smart person. 26 years with the state of Florida, she nets $2,500 a month. $2,500 a month. 26 years with the state of Florida, she's supplementing her income. How dare we consider lessening what we do to our public servants? $900 for her house payment, $300 for her car payment, because her 18-year-old car died. She had to go get a car. May I go on, Mr. Speaker? 18 months behind her mortgage with a bank that doesn't care too much. Yeah, it upset me. I got dinner down, but it took a while. She's got a 25-year-old daughter who's in school at FSU. She's working. Thank goodness her father has insurance because the new federal law allows her to be part of that health insurance. And thank goodness as a part-time employee, she's now going to get extended benefits through FSU. So I asked Samantha, what do you think about the FRS change? She's pretty upset, and let me tell you why. Samantha, her two parents worked for the state of Florida for 30-plus years. They were able to retire after that 30-plus years individually, one working as an engineer for DOT, the other as a social worker at HRS. She got out of college. She asked her father, "Listen, I got this degree. I'm being recruited by Poe Insurance. I can go out in the private sector." And her father said, "You know what? Go with the security. go with a great retirement. Go to the state of Florida and serve the people of Florida. And she elected to do that. Well, what we're doing today is a further dismantling of what I think is a tradition to public service, and that's treating our public servants with dignity. Nobody goes into government to make $1 million. Nobody does. But what I can tell you is this. We've got a problem with these type of bills. We're hurting the pages behind us, and we're hurting all those Samanthas. You know the Samanthas that created your bill analysis? The ones that work to help us create our positions? The Samanthas out in the Big Cypress that are tagging Panthers? The Samanthas that are checking the quality of our water? The Samanthas that pull us over because we ran a red light? Or put out the fire in our home? Or teach our kids? How dare we approve this piece of legislation? Members, I would ask you vote down this today. Thank you.
And I play a clip like that to show you that there are people who stand up to these Republican thefts.
You know, Rick, it does my heart good because you know how I've gotten about it all. It's Democrat or Republican, but boy, when you hear a man like that and you take them for their word, which I do, and it makes my day. I just want to stand up and go, rawr.
Absolutely. And I have another clip from another Democratic giant who understands what it means to stand up for American workers. Somebody who knows that a working class hero is something to be. I'm going to play a clip from some of the one of the most recent statements by the good Senator Elizabeth Warren. This is a discussion about minimum wage that she holds.
So I was very intrigued by the chairman's chart earlier about productivity. And it shows, as I read the numbers, and also as I read the numbers that you cited, Mr. Dubé, that if we just started in 1960, not the high water mark for minimum wage, but a good time on minimum wage, if we started in 1960 and we said that as productivity goes up, that is, as workers are producing more, then the minimum wage is going to go up the same. And if that were the case, the minimum wage today would be about $22 an hour. So my question, Mr. Dubé, with a minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, is what happened to the other $14.75? It sure didn't go to the worker.
That thanks for the question. That's correct. Since early 70s, what we have seen is a divergence in the prosperities of different sections of our population. So, for instance, had the minimum wage kept pace with productivity since 1960, you're correct, it would have stood around $22 an hour today. Now, the answer to your question, who got the other $14, we can answer with the following comparison. Had the minimum wage grown at the same pace at incomes going to the top 1% of the taxpayers, the minimum wage would have stood at $33 an hour before the recession in 2007.
Dr. Dubé, in the studies of what happens when minimum wages have been raised, and you've done the county-to-county matches, were restaurants included in the employers in the measurement of whether or not people were laid off?
Restaurants were one of the primary samples that we looked at because of the high incidence of minimum wage workers. And again, restaurant employment in response to the kind of minimum wage changes did not respond on average. Now, again, is it possible that a single employer didn't lay some people off? Is it possible some employer didn't actually expand? That is difficult to say. The point I'm making is on aggregate in the restaurant industry for the kind of minimum wage changes we saw, we did not see employment change noticeably.
Okay. During my Senate campaign, I ate a number 11 at McDonald's many, many times a week. And I know the price on that one, $7.19. According to the data on the analysis of what would happen if we raised the minimum wage to $10.10 over 3 years, the price increase on that item would be about 4 cents. So instead of being $7.19, it would be $7.23. Are you telling me that's unsustainable?
Senator Warren, not all restaurants are created equal. I'm in the full service restaurant business. And McDonald's has efficiencies, and they operate completely differently than I do. I have many jobs that pay well above the minimum wage. We have a retirement plan. We offer health insurance to our salaried employees. So my business is a little different. I can't raise a 4 cent price. I mean, I don't operate like a fast food restaurant. So I would hope that you'd at least appreciate the distinction.
Well, I do appreciate the distinction, and I'm not going to be in the business of being McDonald's representative, but I think they would talk about also having some higher paid jobs and some opportunities for management and advancement as well. But I get your point. Maybe it's only 4 cents on $7.19, but if your entrees are $14.40, we'll see how fast I can do the math. Are you telling me you can't raise your prices by 8 cents?
You know, it's typically when costs rise, we don't actually raise it just 4 cents. We might actually go a little higher. It has an inflationary effect on the economy. So you may actually be taking away the money you just gave that employee through the minimum wage increase and raise prices throughout the economy.
I have to say, you've now switched your argument from what it was going to do to your business to what it's going to do to the economy. And I think, Dr. Dubé, you've looked at the inflationary effects of increasing the minimum wage. Can you just give us a quick summary on those data?
I think it's uncontroversial amongst economists that a minimum wage increase of this sort would not have a noticeable impact on the overall price level, because it's just the math doesn't add up. The number of people who are getting the raises is not enough for it to show up in some kind of a wage price spiral. So the effects on overall price level, very small.
Thank you.
What an interesting discussion for a U.S. senator. You know, I wonder, Gwen, when's the last time you heard a senator talk about the importance of raising the minimum wage?
It's been a long time. I can't even remember. I think it was just before Jimmy Carter got into office.
And I thought, Senator Warren, Senator Warren has such a great way of using a simple concept, something that anyone can understand. Like, where the hell did that $14 go?
You know, she doesn't really, as the saying is used too often and very, very poorly, they say, dumb it down. She doesn't do that. She makes it simple because it is simple. It's convolution that is just a tool to misdirect people. She doesn't do that. She approaches it from the front and center point of view, and she makes it easier for people to grasp everything in one sentence, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
And Senator Warren, it's going to be very, I hope it is going to be very rewarding to watch and see where she goes, because she's got the jazz. She has really got the jazz, I think. And it's so good. I voted for that office, you know, twice, living up in Boston. And I was very proud to cast a vote for the man who held it for so long. It's really nice to know somebody with some jazz has got it again.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm a pretty skeptical person when it comes to most office holders. Yeah. And I managed to scrape up some money to send to that particular candidate, because everything I had heard then candidate Warren and now Senator Warren said convinces me that her heart is in the right place and she understands what real democracy is about. Well, Prince,
she's a smart cookie.
That's for sure. Before we go any further, and I think you're going to really learn a lot from this this rebroadcast of this Fukushima seminar. But I do want to mention my colleagues out there in the progressive media, especially my good friend Gwen Holdenberry and her show There Be Monsters. What was your topic tonight, Gwen?
We actually took Representative Wasserman Schultz to task for her commentary about sequester and her 60K to 160K a year interns being, you know, put out by it because they really don't like to pay more money for their vegetarian lunches. It was hubris. It was hubris. And unfortunately, it's coming out of that office quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. A real Democrat's Democrat. If your idea of a Democrat is Max
driven.
Baucus or Wild Bill Clinton. Okay.
Yeah.
I also want to mention our good friends Brian Stetton, his show Progress Toward Democracy, Susan Nylon, The Nylon Report, Harriet Lerman and her Voice of the People show, and CETA Media from the great progressive Sita Begui, who has a show out on the East Coast in the Brevard area. So make sure you tune in to these great, great progressive leaders. Gwen, especially, I salute you. You are the standard
thank
that many
you.
Of us measure ourselves by. You do a great job.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Oh, my goodness.
Okay. Without any further ado, let me play the first segment. This is Cindy Folker. Cindy is with an organization called Beyond Nuclear, and she's going to talk about the nuclear exposure. Many of us have assumed that when they talk about the dangerous levels of nuclear radiation, they know what they're talking about, and Cindy's got an analysis of what's really going on with radiation exposure. This is Cindy Folker from Beyond Nuclear, part of the Caldecott Foundation Seminar Symposium on Fukushima. Here we go.
Don't find that cesium gamma. It doesn't mean the food doesn't contain other radionuclides that are of concern, like strontium-90, plutonium-239. So obviously measuring food for just gamma has serious limitations, but it would be a reasonable start in any food testing program. Fukushima isn't the only source of cesium contamination. We have been being exposed to man-made radiation for generations from a number of different sources. So atomic bomb blasts worldwide, 954 petabecquerels, I will use quadrillion. And to give you an illustration of what a quadrillion is, if you have a quadrillion pennies on top of each other, they would reach the sun and back five times over. This is a big number. Every nuclear power reactor releases radionuclides to water and air as part of their operating plan. It doesn't take an accident to release this material, although we know they've had plenty of those as well. A total release amount for cesium-134 and 137 is currently unavailable and would have to be calculated for the U.S. nuclear power reactor fleet. It would also be based on questionable effluent release data that is most often collected by industry, not independent parties. Then there's Chernobyl. 85 quadrillion becquerels of cesium-137. This number has a margin of plus or minus 26 petabecquerels. So that's 26 quadrillion becquerels. Fukushima releases to air and ocean. Release of noble gas, unspecified as to what type it was. These numbers are from a TEPCO press release that came out earlier on. And finally, 10 million becquerels of cesium-134 and 137 are still, as far as I know, being released every hour. Now, what these slides have shown us is that we don't have a good idea of just how much cesium has been released or continues to be released. Who's testing? So who's testing our food for man-made radioactivity? Vital Choice and Eden are private companies who pay to have their products tested. Berkeley Nuclear Department ran about 115 total samples. I think all of them were from California. Most were from 2011. FDA, EPA, and DOE have severely curtailed their monitoring since the initial days of the accident. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration was thought to be watching something called the Kuroshio Current, which somebody mentioned yesterday in a presentation. And if the contamination reached this current, they would consider monitoring California coast seawater and sediment. But I don't think they're doing that yet, and I believe the contamination has reached this current, which is like a fast track to the California Pacific coast. These aren't the only universities and institutes that have done testing, but the testing has been limited. It needs more money to continue, and there has been complaining about lack of funding for this very important work. Current and past food testing programs have a number of shortcomings. Most samples are only tested for gamma-emitting radionuclides. Testing has been severely curtailed now, even though Fukushima is still spewing and the contamination is becoming entrenched. EPA was criticized by the Inspector General because 20% of its radiation monitors in the U.S. were out of service when the Fukushima catastrophe began. And a very important point, and I want everyone to hear this, sampling a piece of food every once in a while gives you no real idea of the scope of the contamination or the bioaccumulation and doesn't pinpoint any radiation hotspots that might exist. So in general, testing of U.S. foodstuffs is inadequate. The U.S. limit of 1,200 becquerels per kilogram of just cesium-134 and or 137 is way too high. And it isn't binding, because the FDA can decide to act or not at any level of cesium contamination. So it's exactly like not having a standard at all. Japan, on the other hand, their limit is 100 becquerels per kilogram. Finally, release of info to the public is paltry, if at all. So what have they found so far? California kelp. Iodine levels were significantly higher than before Fukushima. They didn't test it for cesium, and they should. They've asked for funding. I don't know if they've got it. I don't know an update on this, but this is important because kelp provides a food source for fish. So there is concern that contamination from the fish that eat the kelp will be concentrated within the fish. Pistachios grown in California were shipped to a Japanese supermarket. The Japanese supermarket tested 18 becquerels per kilogram of cesium-134 and 137. Beef raised in Japan was tested and approved for market sale and then recalled, but not before it was fed to Japanese school children. All of this beef could have been sold to the U.S., and the FDA may not have pulled it. California grass, 14 becquerels per kilogram, cesium-134 and 137. Grass, like kelp, is the beginning of a potential biomagnification chain which could concentrate cesium in cattle, for instance. And as Berkeley put it on their monitoring site, for understanding the time dependence of food chain results, the grass and soil is what to look at. Green tea, 162 kilograms of it shipped to France from Japan and rejected because of this level of contamination, 1,038. The U.S. recommendations would have accepted this. Bluefin tuna swam all the way across the Pacific and reached the California coast, retaining cesium-134 and 137. Canada's cesium limit is apparently 1,000 becquerels per kilogram of cesium. And news reports expressed concern that they will import very contaminated fish from Japan. It is a concern that the U.S. should also share. They were also concerned because contamination was higher in 2012 than it had been in 2011, and this fits with cesium's tendency to biomagnify, but we will have to stay tuned, and we should keep measuring ocean fish from the Pacific for cesium. Because of the tendency to biomagnify, in general, we need more testing, and we need to think about how to test over a longer time frame, not just a few years. So how should we think about these contamination levels, and how low should we attempt to make cesium contamination in our food? Remember two things. There's no safe level of radiation. Every exposure does carry some risk, no matter how small. And two, cesium-134 and 137 did not exist in nature before we created and released them. This graph is from ICRP Report 111. ICRP stands for International Commission on Radiological Protection. They recommend how much exposure is okay for humans. Governments follow these recommendations when setting standards. This graph shows us even what are considered very small amounts of cesium when ingested routinely can build up to unexpected levels in the body. So it specifically shows that after about 3 years, ingesting 10 becquerels per day of cesium-137 can cause a buildup to over 1,400 becquerels total cesium-137 in your body. For a child who weighs about 30 kilograms or about 66 pounds, this would be about 50 becquerels per kilogram of cesium-137 in them. And this number is important because in studies of post-Chernobyl Belarus, cardiac abnormalities, heart problems, developed in children whose bodies contain 10 to 30 becquerels per kilogram of cesium. Irreversible myocardiopathologies develop at 50 becquerels per kilogram. Additional pathologies at these low levels can include hormone imbalances, angina, diabetes, and hypertension, which, by the way, are all sort of aging diseases as well. In addition to these diseases, as cesium passes out of your body, its radioactivity starts to damage your kidneys and your bladder, which in turn damages your body's ability to rid itself of the cesium. This could mean that your body could collect cesium more quickly than this graph currently shows, which means the total amount of cesium in your body would be higher over time than this graph shows from chronic ingestion. Why is the U.S. guideline so high? And how about Canada's? Well, it seems to be some sort of official policy to encourage people to accept increasingly radioactive food. Consider this quote also from ICRP Report 111. There may be situations where a sustainable agricultural economy is not possible without placing contaminated food on the market. As such, foods will be subject to market forces. This will necessitate an effective communication strategy to overcome the negative reactions from consumers outside the contaminated areas. So their plan consists not of informing the public that these contamination levels, what the contamination levels are, so that we can decide for ourselves what is and is not appropriate. It consists instead of convincing us that man-made radiation in small doses is not harmful. So what are we going to do about this? Well, Beyond Nuclear, in coalition with other groups that are part of the Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network, or FAN, are in the process of petitioning the Food and Drug Administration of the United States for a binding contamination limit of 5 becquerels per kilogram of cesium-134 and 137. We're also asking for testing of soils and other things. We are asking that the testing be widespread and that the data collected be recorded in a publicly available database, no matter what the cesium contamination level. A database of this information, if constructed properly, could inform research on cesium mobility, biomagnification in the environment, so it could have a broad usefulness, not just for consumers, but for research as well. If you want an easy-to-understand resource on this whole issue, Silence Deafening, Fukushima Fallout, A Mother's Response by Kimberly Roberson speaks to the urgent need for food monitoring as radiation from nuclear power is now migrating to our homes and kitchens. And, of course, I'm with Beyond Nuclear. We have a newsletter. We're going to be having a public petition so that people can sign on this issue. We haven't got it up and running yet. But stick with our website, info@beyondnuclear.org, and you can request our weekly newsletter. So, concluding remarks. When I first started to collect information that would help me recommend a level for cesium contamination in food, and 5 becquerels per kilogram was being bandied about, I wondered if this limit and the testing, that testing most of our food supply was somehow unreasonable. Through my research, I concluded no, for several reasons. Cesium concentrates or biomagnifies in the environment through natural processes, so diluting it won't save us ultimately. We have to track it and its movements. Historic and continuing cesium releases ensure that generations of humans have now been exposed to it. To what end? what is the damage that has already been done that we may not be able to see? And I'm thinking of multi-generational damage here. Belarus studies show damage at very low levels in children, and ICRP admits that even small amounts of cesium can bioaccumulate in our bodies to this level. There's a lack of publicly available info on cesium levels in food, and we have no reliable estimate on how much has been or is being released. And then finally, they are attempting to convince us everything is fine, despite all that we and they still don't know and all of the uncertainties. And what we do know and what we've seen here in this conference is very, very worrisome. So it isn't just a question anymore of which catastrophe or routine release is to blame for what cesium contamination or any contamination. It's a question of the totality of the radioactive contamination and the damage occurring from it across generations. And cesium is only one of very many radioactive isotopes released. So looking at this evidence, I am now thinking that 5 becquerels per kilogram might still ultimately be too high, but it is a good start to get a handle on what is contaminated, what isn't, and how we move forward. Thank you.
That was Cindy Folker of Beyond Nuclear. And in case you didn't get that web address, it's beyondnuclear.org. Any reaction to that, Gwen?
Well, it's the same incredible feeling that I've had since the beginning of the tsunami, finding out that four reactors had been, actually six, but four had been damaged so much, and to know that they're still pouring millions of gallons of salt water over these rods to cool them down. They have not been contained. I don't understand, you know, between TEPCO, which is actually General Electric, the leadership of this planet, how this can go on. How can they allow this to go on and not take initiative and action and leadership on it? Because the Japanese are not, you know, we're not hearing about it, but the truth is there are thousands in the streets over this, over in Japan, over this. There's serious things happening that we're not being told over there.
Yep. There's a lot of information that comes out across this, and I hope that those of you who are listening spread the word, because this is a very, very valuable resource of information. Just one of the points that you're going to hear in a little while is conventionally when they warn you about radioactive fallout from one of these accidents or incidents, they draw a circle around it and say, well, the radius is such and such. In fact, there was a discussion in Japan. They said, well, a 10-mile radius, you should evacuate. Everybody else is safe. But you'll find out that the American military and the American government said, look, if you're within 50 miles of that thing, you better get the hell out of there.
Yeah,
and my question about it, they said, no, it's it's just a precaution. But, of course, when you talk about the nuclear power reactors here in this country, they say, well, it's a 10-mile radius. So they can't really keep their story straight. And this next one, this next segment is about the history of nuclear power. And I think you're going to find this is every bit as informative as the last one, if not more so, because this is going to talk about how nuclear power really came to be as an apologia for our nuclear weapons use. Here we go. This is Kevin Camps on the history of nuclear power, part of the Caldecott Symposium on Fukushima. Here we go, part one, history.
Now, third speaker is going to be Kevin Camps, and he's going to talk about 70 years of our radioactive risks in Japan and the United States.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks so much to Helen and Molly for this event. It's a real honor to speak here. Yep, and apologies if I rush through, especially slides that echo what others have previously presented. But I I've got a lot of ground to cover, as you can see from the title. So I found this image really striking. This is an image from Hiroshima after the bombing, actually, but I just found it so remarkably similar to the post-tsunami scenes that we all remember from 2 years ago. And of course, the comment has been made that even by the likes of the Prime Minister of Japan at the time, that the events of March 11th, 2011 are similar in magnitude and importance as things like the Hiroshima atomic bombing to the Japanese nation. So this is a view of Fukushima Daiichi before the catastrophe began, and I was invited on a speaking tour of Japan in August of 2010, 7 months before the catastrophe, and I stood on a bluff over the Pacific that looked down on Fukushima Daiichi. My first stop was Okuma and Futaba on the speaking tour. So 3.5 miles to the north, I could see the 6 reactors like this. And 3.5 miles to the south, from where I stood, I could see the Daini nuclear power plant with 4 reactors. And it's little known, but a single off-site power line is what saved Daini, more operating reactors than at Daiichi, from a similar catastrophe. Several off-site power lines were lost to the earthquake. The emergency diesel generators were lost to the tsunami. And that was the kind of scenario that Prime Minister Kan, his at the time Chief Cabinet Secretary Adano, admitted to the Rebuild Japan Initiative Foundation. And the headlines came out on the first anniversary of the Fukushima catastrophe. They feared a demonic chain reaction of atomic reactor meltdowns and pool fires. 6 reactors, well, 3 operating at Daiichi, but 7 pools at Daiichi. 4 operating reactors at Daini and 4 pools. 1 reactor and 1 pool at Tokai, closer to Tokyo. And that's where the headlines came from about the possibility of having to evacuate Tokyo if that worst-case scenario had played out. 30 million people. But something that the filmmaker Kurosawa envisioned in his film Dreams in 1990 in the part called Mount Fuji in Red, atomic reactors exploding behind Mount Fuji as seen from Tokyo. So here are the explosions at the Unit 1 and the Unit 3, and the aftermath in mid-March of 2011. But it's not the first time, and I should mention that the reactors, of course, are General Electric Mark I boiling water reactors, so there's an instant tie between this Japanese catastrophe and U.S. involvement. But, of course, our nuclear involvement, so to speak, goes back 70 years. And we just held a conference in Chicago to mark the 70th year since Enrico Fermi fired up the first atomic reactor in the world, the Chicago Pile 1, as part of the Manhattan Project, the race for the bomb. So you can see an image, an artist rendition of the pile there. This is Enrico Fermi. And the title of the conference was A Mountain of Radioactive Waste 70 Years High. So, of course, this was all about the bomb. And these are images of the mushroom clouds at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so the radioactive risks began with the bomb project. And I should have mentioned that Enrico Fermi took a calculated risk, or maybe it was an uncalculated risk, at the University of Chicago. The original plan was to build that prototype reactor some 20 miles, 30 miles outside of town, where argon is now located. And there was no time. They couldn't do it in time, so they decided to just do it at the University of Chicago. They didn't even inform the president of the university. They're doing this on the edge of downtown Chicago, and Fermi convinced his higher-ups that probably it would be okay. But some of his graduate students were assigned the task of what they called the suicide squad, and this was to pour a chemical solution onto the pile if something went wrong. There was another individual called the safety control rod Axeman, who literally, with his axe, would chop a rope that was over a pulley and drop the control rod into the out-of-control reactor. And that term, scram, still sticks in the nuclear power industry. But as we saw at Fukushima Daiichi, you can scram a reactor when a 9.0 earthquake strikes, but the decay heat is enough to melt it down if you can't cool the cores. So again, with the history, we see Oppenheimer and Groves at the Trinity Blast site. This was the precursor to the Nagasaki plutonium bomb and the aftermath of that. So they didn't have to test the uranium bomb. It was sure to work, so they didn't test it. But, you know, as has been mentioned by Dr. Fairley and Mary Olson, the fallout from the Cold War, atomic bomb tests and hydrogen bomb tests. And this next section, Brian Victoria is right in the front row, so I owe a debt of gratitude to Professor Victoria because I learned history coming to Antioch University Midwest last Earth Day last year that I hadn't known about the early U.S. involvement in the Japanese nuclear power industry. So, atomic weapons testing in the Pacific. In mid-March of 2011, I happened to catch one of the episodes of CBS Evening News with Katie Couric, and it was about Fukushima that day, and they show these images on the right of the USS Ronald Reagan crew swabbing the decks in radiation protection gear because of being blanketed from Fukushima. And it just harkened back to these images from as early as 1946. And granted, that's a photo op. You can see the sailors are smiling, but they bore the brunt of that health damage over the years and decades after that. They are the atomic veterans. The atom bomb testing going on in the Pacific, a Cold War arms race with the Soviets well underway, and President Eisenhower gives a speech called Atoms for Peace at the United Nations in the early 1950s. And Arjun Makajani at IEER has written just an incredible book, if you haven't read it. It's called The Nuclear Power Deception. Came out in 1999, and I learned a lot about the propaganda machine, which was Atoms for Peace, because uranium mining and milling and processing and enrichment all had to be expanded for this arms race we were in with the Soviets. But how to sell that to the American people? Well, Atoms for Peace. It put a smiley-faced facade on this major expansion of all things nuclear. And remember, this is the early 1950s. The first so-called civilian atomic reactor was not fired up in Shippingport, Pennsylvania, under the direction of the head of the nuclear navy. So it's a civilian project, but it's a nuclear submarine reactor built on land just to get it going. A lot, or even most, or even all of the uranium in this country was being milled, being mined and milled and processed and enriched, was feeding the arms race for not years, but decades, until the commercial industry started to really show up in the 1970s, and then the uranium supply started to shift over somewhat to fuel those reactors. So this, again, the history that I learned from Brian Victoria. Castle was a series of hydrogen bomb tests that the United States carried out at places like Bikini. And on March 1st of 1954, the Bravo test got a little out of control. Edward Teller was involved in designing this bomb, as were other scientists, and they miscalculated the yield of this explosion. They expected a 5-megaton blast, and they got more like a 15-megaton blast. And it still is the worst radiological contamination incident in the history of U.S. nuclear weapons testing. And this Japanese tuna fishing boat, the Lucky Dragon number 5, was unfortunately not very far away. You can see in the map on the right there, the blast, Bikini marked by a B, the Lucky Dragon marked by the F. They were outside of the zone that the United States had declared off limits. But then later they redrew the danger zone, and they were well within that danger zone. And over time, half of the crew of 23 died of their radiation exposures. One of the deaths occurred pretty quickly, within a matter of months, and it led to an anti-nuclear groundswell in Japan, including a petition drive with many tens of millions of signatures against atomic bomb tests and against hydrogen bomb tests, and 1 million signatures alone from Hiroshima area. And the United States became very worried because there was this large groundswell of opposition to the nuclear energy establishment. And there were fears that even the Soviet Union or China could take advantage of this situation in the competition for loyalties after World War II. So again, the juxtaposition of images old and new. So on the left, officials from the city of Tokyo testing the tuna from the Lucky Dragon and finding severe contamination. But like Cindy talked about, some of that tuna had already been sold, had already been consumed before it was quarantined. And then on the right, this is actually an image from Thailand, it's not from Japan, but also dealing with the contamination of seafood post-Fukushima. And this was brand new to me that I learned from my visit to Antioch. So a part of the United States response to try to shore up Adams for Peace was to actually deploy the Central Intelligence Agency to Japan. And this individual on the left is Louis Strauss, the head of the Atomic Energy Commission. And the Atomic Energy Commission took a lead role in downplaying the significance of the food contamination in Japan. And this individual on the right, Shiriki, fascinating story, compared to Citizen Kane of Japan, a media mogul who controlled one of the largest newspapers, one of the largest television stations in Japan, had higher ambitions for political office, was a founder of the Liberal Democratic Party of Japan, and in 2006 it was documented that he was working with the Central Intelligence Agency under a couple code names, and one of his assignments was to sell nuclear power to the Japanese people, and he did it with a passion. And so the infamous nuclear village was born, and this image is just one example. The speaker from the investigation by the Japanese parliament showed other images of the propaganda used. This is a plutonium boy, and of course these are geared for children. And so exhibits were shown across the country just as they were here in the United States, traveling exhibits. And I, during my time in Japan in 2010, I went to one of these kind of Disneyland-like experiences at a nuclear power plant, which are really geared for young children. And one of the first companies to take advantage of this situation was a company that Mr. Shiriki worked with, and that was General Dynamics, that got in early on the nuclear business in Japan. But General Electric was not too far behind. So here's, you know, a grand total of about 140 atomic reactors in the U.S. 104 are still operating, but you got to take off Crystal River, Florida, 103 now. Take off Kewaunee, Wisconsin, 102. Sorry that Canada's not on the map because there are, you know, 20-plus reactors in Canada, but take off Jeanty 2 in Quebec. So there are dominoes on the brink of tipping over, and we need to shut them down before they melt down. This is Atomic Japan, third only to the United States, and then France with 58 reactors, Japan with 54, plus Manju, the fast breeder reactor. One of the places in Japan, Fukui Prefecture, a remarkable number of reactors, more than a dozen, along a short stretch of coastline. And what I want to do for the next section of the talk is just go through the parallels between U.S. and Japanese nuclear history in terms of accidents, incidents. They're remarkably parallel. And what I took was just an arbitrary list. The Associated Press, shortly after the beginning of the Fukushima catastrophe, put a list of, you know, a short list of 10 or so Japanese nuclear accidents that had already occurred before Fukushima. So I took that list because it could be much longer, and I compared it to ones here in North America. So you see on the left Suruga nuclear power plant, but you see on the right the Bruce nuclear power plant in Ontario. This is worker overexposures. So in 1981, 300 workers were exposed to excessive levels of radiation after a fuel rod ruptured at Suruga. And it reminded me of an incident in Michigan at Big Rock Point, an experimental atomic reactor, where a MOX fuel rod was broken in the 1970s and 700,000 curies of radioactivity were released. But Bruce is also on the Great Lakes in Canada. And just recently, in 2009, there was an exposure of hundreds of workers to alpha particle radiation when they were grinding through contaminated pipes. They had no respiratory protection on. And before moving on from the Bruce slide, I just wanted to mention that this is one of the biggest nuclear power plants, certainly in North America. It's the biggest, and even in the world. There's a total of 9 reactors on this site. They're even proposing a low and intermediate level radioactive waste dump for all of Ontario's 20 reactors worth of waste, a burial site, 400 yards from the water of Lake Huron. But there are a half dozen communities, mostly populated by Bruce workers, that want to be the high-level radioactive waste dump for all of Canada. And the Great Lakes is 20% of the world's surface fresh water, drinking water supply for 40 million people in North America. So this next parallel is sodium fires. And you see Manju and Fukui Prefecture suffered a bad sodium fire in 1995. Videotape footage of the damage was concealed for a time and then later got released. But Fermi Unit 1 in Monroe County, Michigan, suffered a sodium fire, suffered tritium leaks in 2008. And what's remarkable about that is it had permanently shut down in 1972. These were decommissioning accidents at Fermi 1. Fermi 1 was made famous or infamous by an October 5th, 1966 partial meltdown of the reactor core, captured in the book We Almost Lost Detroit. So talk about a cover-up. That was a 10-year cover-up of a partial meltdown in Michigan until John Fuller wrote this book. The next parallels reprocessing plant fires and explosions. Now, this is a lesser-known accident at Tokai Mura in Japan. March 11th, 1997, ironically the same date as the later Fukushima catastrophe. And 40 workers were exposed to radiation in this reprocessing. Yeah, I got a problem because I can't see my notes on the screen. So the parallel in the United States is right here in the state of New York at West Valley near Buffalo, a commercial reprocessing facility that operated from 1966 to 1972. But they had so many fires and leaks and worker overexposures at West Valley that they only did 1 year's worth of reprocessing throughput. They also did military reprocessing at that site. And the cleanup bill at West Valley is between $10 and $27 billion. And it's not even hardly begun. And if they do not clean that site up, it is going to erode into Lakes Erie and Ontario over time. So it has to be cleaned up. So the more infamous nuclear disaster at Tokai Mura was the inadvertent criticality of 1999. Two workers died from their radiation exposures. And another inadvertent criticality took place in 1999, but again, the truth was covered up for 8 years, and it wasn't known that there had been a 30-minute, I believe, criticality in the reactor core. Sorry, 15 minutes. And a similar thing had happened at Fermi Unit 2, which I'll show on this slide. Fermi 2, which is the biggest General Electric Mark I boiling water reactor in the world, same design as Fukushima Daiichi, only as big as Units 1 and 2 at Fukushima Daiichi put together. They had an inadvertent criticality in 1985, and the watchdog, Michael Keegan, with Dumb Waste Michigan, outed it. And it kept that reactor shut down for 3 years because they didn't have a permit to run the reactor. They just did it accidentally. Luckily, no one was hurt. So the safety cover-ups continued. Tokyo Electric Power Company, the book about Tokyo Electric is called Dark Empire. So it starts to capture their behavior. So in 2000, three TEPCO executives were forced to resign after the revelation that in 1989, the company had ordered an employee to edit out footage showing cracks in nuclear plant steam pipes in video that was shown to regulators. Of course, they eventually were allowed to restart their reactors. And there was another cover-up in Japan that was outed by the Japanese anti-nuclear movement. Eileen Miyoko-Smith at Green Action told me this story. The British Nuclear Fuel Limited MOX fuel supply with falsified quality assurance figures, that it took tremendous efforts to document this, but they did, that those were falsified figures. They simply photocopied the results of earlier batches, so to speak, cut and paste, which caused a huge delay in the plutonium thermal loading in Japan. So another cover-up I want to mention here in the United States is Davis-Besse, Ohio, which had a massive corrosion hole in the lid of the reactor in 2002 and operated to within 3/16 of an inch of breaching the lid through nearly 7 inches of carbon steel. And again, cover-ups. Video footage was edited before the NRC was allowed to see it. This photograph, though, the NRC had in its possession, still did not take action. This is a lava stream, so to speak, of boric acid crystals and rust coming off of the lid. And the former NRC chairman, Richard Meserve, his fingerprints are all over this near disaster. junior inspectors at NRC wanted to shut the plant down, inspect, see what was going on. Meserve and other senior management at NRC allowed the reactor to operate to the brink of disaster. And the Office of Inspector General at NRC later reported that NRC had prioritized company profits over public safety. Meserve resigned shortly after that report, and unfortunately is still brought to Tokyo, as in December, for consultation on nuclear safety matters. He also is the chairman of all things nuclear at the National Academy of Science, even though he serves on two for-profit nuclear utility corporate boards, Pacific Gas and Electric in California and Comanche in Texas. And through grassroots activism, was forced to recuse himself from the current radiation study on cancer incidents associated with nuclear power plants in the United States. So more examples of the close parallels between the U.S. and Japan. There have been not radioactive, but steam accidents where workers have been killed. So at Mihama Unit 3 in Fukui, again, four workers were killed after a steam explosion. The subsequent investigation revealed a significant lack of systematic inspections at Japanese nuclear power plants. Surrey in Virginia, which David Lochbaum mentioned yesterday, may have cleaned up its act a bit after two separate steam fatality accidents. One killed two workers in 1972, another one killed four workers in 1986, and that's the single largest loss of life at nuclear power plant in the United States. Surrey's also infamous because they're experimenting with dry cask storage out there. They have a real smorgasbord of different cask models, and they've had problems. They've had leaks of the inerting heat transfer gas out of one seal, perhaps out of a second seal. It hasn't leaked completely out, but if it does, oxygen can get in, the waste can overheat, and you can have corrosion of deterioration of the fuel inside. So this slide is about radioactive steam releases. Now, these are not scalding people to death, but they do contain radioactivity that then leaves the site. Daiichi had such an incident in 2006. A really controversial one was the January 2012 steam release from a failed steam generator tube at San Onofre in Southern California. The two units at San Onofre are still shut down 14 months now due to a faulty design and fabrication of steam generator replacements, which cost $617 million. And for details on that, Arne Gunderson is the expert witness for Friends of the Earth on this matter, and hopefully those reactors will never start up again. There's a groundswell of anti-nuclear activism in Southern California to keep them shut down. So earthquake risks. Before Daiichi, there was the 2007 quake, ironically on the Trinity atomic blast anniversary at Kajiwazaki Kariwa, which is the largest nuclear power plant in the world, seven large-scale reactors, some of which had begun to come back to service, but then the 2011 earthquake catastrophe, of course, has shut down all operable reactors in Japan except for two in Fukui Prefecture at the Oi nuclear power plant. Earthquake risks at Indian Point. Indian Point happens to be located immediately adjacent to earthquake faults that were not known about when it was constructed. And seismologists at Columbia University confirmed their existence in 2008, and the NRC has been forced to admit that this is probably the most vulnerable nuclear power plant in the country to earthquake risks because it wasn't built that well. Granted, Diablo Canyon and San Onofre are still vulnerable to earthquakes and tsunamis, but they were built more strongly because there was a recognition that San Andreas was right there. Indian Point, they had no such appreciation. And this image shows Indian Point in the distant background on the Hudson River, and Mrs. Sashiko Sato, a Fukushima organic farmer, Eileen Miyoko Smith from Green Action, and also an organic farmer from Hokkaido, and another leader of the anti-nuclear movement in Hokkaido. We went up to visit the Indian Point Safe Energy Coalition folks. That was September 2012. So this is just the cover of the New Yorker, another haunting image from March of 2011 that was published on the date of the Three Mile Island anniversary, actually, March 28th. And so I just wanted to go to some additional risks that weren't mentioned in that AP article from March of 2011 in Japan and their parallels in the U.S. reactor pressure vessel embrittlement, the neutron bombardment of the 8-inch or so metal walls of a reactor pressure vessel over years and decades, and the impurities in the metal creating cracks which can line up, and that if the emergency core cooling systems are ever activated, the final line of defense to prevent a meltdown, the thermal shock of the temperature decrease combined with the high pressure can crack these vessels. And if that happens, it would be an irreparable loss of coolant accident. There's no contingency in place. So the worst in Japan, the worst in the United States, another Entergy atomic reactor, just like Indian Point. Risks that have been mentioned are the high-level radioactive waste storage pools that are not located in radiological containment structures. Bob Alvarez talks about that much better than I can. We're having headlines about leaks at Hanford, and the irony of this is it harkens back 70 years, really, because Hanford generated the plutonium for the Nagasaki atomic bomb, continued to for the Cold War arsenal. Well, those high-level radioactive waste liquid and sludge storage tanks, the single-shelled ones, when they leak, it's directly into the environment. The first double shell had a leak in August. Granted, it's between the walls of the two shells. They're not out yet, but it shows there's problems. Leaks at high-level radioactive waste storage pools in the United States. There are more than a half dozen pools in the U.S. that have documented leaks. Indian Point's pool leak is ongoing as we speak. Brookhaven's is very significant because millions of people drink the water in the aquifer under Long Island. So false solutions, a big fight that's coming our way, centralized interim storage. They want to put the waste onto the roads, the rails, the waterways, including the Hudson River, is possibly targeted for 58 barge shipments of high-level radioactive waste from Indian Point down to the port of Jersey City. To get it to parking lot dumps, whether at a place like Savannah River Site on the right here, or Waste Isolation Pilot Plant in New Mexico, or Native American reservations out west, all for what? To create a shell game on the roads and rails and waterways, because if it goes to a parking lot dump for 50 years, it may have to go right back to where it came from for permanent disposal. It accomplishes nothing except transfer of liability onto the American taxpayer from the utilities that profited from the generation. I mentioned the good news at Kewanee of shutdown. The only two reactors in Japan currently operating are these, OE, but the other 48 operable reactors in the country are not operating, and it's a real testament to the Japanese people and anti-nuclear movement. A lot of this has already been talked about by previous speakers. The 1972 warnings that the Mark I was a catastrophically flawed reactor. The GE3 blew the whistle in 1976. Also in 1986, the NRC's point man at Three Mile Island warned about the Mark I. So we have a campaign at Beyond Nuclear called Freeze Our Fukushimas. In the immediate aftermath of the Fukushima catastrophe beginning, we prioritize the Mark I's and Mark II's. If we can't shut these down for safety risks, then, you know, what can we shut down after Fukushima? The Japanese parliament identified collusion between regulator and industry as the root cause of the Fukushima catastrophe. We have collusion in spades in the United States between the nuclear power industry, and here are four of the five NRC commissioners. They are poised to pass a majority vote against putting filters on the vents at the Mark I's and Mark II's, bowing to pressure from industry and from House Republicans. So Gene Silp, who's a watchdog on Three Mile Island, a survivor of the accident, lives in Harrisburg, showed up in Michigan in 1999 with a banner that said, Three Mile Island, this is a Bob Del Tredici photo, Chernobyl, and he said, where next? And, of course, we have to add Fukushima to the list, and we again have to ask, where next? We have to shut them down before they melt down. Thank you.
So you can see a history of collusion, cover-ups, officials who've been to the designs of the industry, regulators who are either toothless, bought off, or otherwise compromised. It's not a pretty picture.
No, it's not. And it get when you pay attention and you get all of this information, it's hard to digest. Because we're talking about the nuclear industry. We're talking about the planetary lifespan.
Well, I think it's important to be informed. That's why I wanted to do this. Not a pretty picture, but important for us to know. The next presentation by Miss Mary Olson, who's going to talk about the fact that there's a gender bias that's invisible in the documentation, and unfortunately, women and children are far more vulnerable than the military soldiers who the original guidelines were set to. So let's go ahead and listen to Miss Mary Olson, who's going to talk about the gender and the nuclear issue. And the main comment is there is no safe dose. Here we go. Mary Olson from the Caldecott Symposium.
So here we are, Fukushima Plus 2. It has a beginning, but quite frankly, in the human frame, it has no end. And prevention is the only cure, to quote my good friends at Physicians for Social Responsibility, who I thank as well for this event. I want to start with some news, though. I got home to email last night and found out that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has permanently denied a license for the very first time ever. To acknowledge that it's been multiple organizations, including Beyond Nuclear, but Michael Marriott at Nuclear Information and Resource Service did an incredible job as lead intervener to challenge the license for new reactor construction close to Washington, D.C. So as we ended our session this morning with the view that we need to move from study to protection, I would say, and prevention. And we have just seen an amazing act on the anniversary of Fukushima by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It is an anomalous point right now, but let's see a build in that direction. That circle is empty, and it's going to stay that way. So I'm taking a page from some of my colleagues to cut to the chase and get to the point. I'm here to talk to you about gender, and I'm going to unfold this, but many people don't know how to read a graph. And so I want to take just a moment to return to this picture that Stephen Starr gave us yesterday. I want to acknowledge Ian Goddard for creating the graphic. And this information, as we'll talk about more, comes from the National Academy of Sciences Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation 7, or BIR-7. Again, we'll get there. But look across the bottom. That's the lifespan, 0 to 80. We hope longer, but this graph ends at 80. And look at the vertical. That's increased cancer risk by exposure to a given amount of radiation. And I want to just say that I think that this is a little bit of a fictional story here, but it's a very important pink line and blue line. What is the blue line? The blue line is boys turning to men, turning to old men. What is the pink line? The pink line is little girls turning to women, turning to old women. And if you look at that left-hand part, that is 0 to 5 years lumped together graphically by Ian, but it's actually a five-year group. And it includes pre-birth. And what do we see? We see a striking difference between the blue line and the pink line. Now, Ian added the little green, I don't think I have a pointer here, maybe I do. Anyway, he added the little green circle that's on the 30-year-old male blue line. Because that is what our regulators assume to be the individual who's getting any dose of radiation that we're talking about yesterday and today. All of the radiation we've been talking about assumes that is the individual getting that dose. Whereas this graph really unfolds the entire life cycle of our species, if you want to take these numbers. These numbers are suspect. But how suspect are they? Are we going to flush a 100% difference between 0 and 5, between the blue line and the pink line? Are we going to ignore it completely? And even at the point of the green circle, this graph is a little bit off, I think, because there's a 50%, 40 to 60% difference between adult males and adult females. So I'm about to move fairly quickly through a bunch of pictures that are going to be very interlaced with others you've seen. Hopefully you take that as very confirmatory that we are, as a community, are seeing a lot of the same stuff. But I do want to just acknowledge that this level of radiation exposure is the same one that we call 2 REMS in the United States, that is the limit for atomic workers, and also the amount of radiation that the Japanese officials have said it's okay for school children to get while they're in school in the contaminated areas of Japan. Not even the amount that they're getting total at home and going back and forth and playing outside, just the amount that they would get while they're in school. So it's called low dose. In my book, it's not very low. So that graph tells us something. It tells us that one rad does not fit all. We've known for a long time that primary germ cells in the embryo are far more vulnerable. We heard about that today. The fetus, children, their cells are dividing much more rapidly. Their bodies are smaller. Alice Stewart taught us that elders have a bump up in their vulnerability as well. Their repair mechanisms maybe aren't working as much. Some genotypes. We have a whole oncology field that's now tied to what is your DNA. And we know that some people are more likely to get radiologically caused cancers. And now we have to add to that list a gender difference, that females, both juvenile and adult, are more sensitive. So it matters who gets the radiation, not just how long, not just how much, not just what kind. And ultimately, I think this does raise the question of what do we mean by dose? But what I mean by being here is to stand and say it's time to stop letting Monday be the only driver. Let's kick Wall Street out of the decision-making role. I'm being a knowledge translator. I'm being an activist. But we have to collectively, as a society, move towards prevention and precaution as the basis of policy. And I believe that means we have to get a whole lot more women motivated to get involved. Sadly, it's too late for prevention for a lot of what we're seeing. And I think that slide that talked about cesium from the weapons test is incredibly important in this picture. But I got to say the other names: Hiroshima, Nagasaki, weapons test, Kishtim, wind scale, Santa Susana, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima. Are there others that we don't even know about? This is that big release. 2 days in between each of these reconstructions, Chernobyl, from April 26, 1986 to May 8, 1986, resulting in that 10 days in 40% of Europe having cesium contamination above the 4,000 becquerel per square meter level. And we've heard you don't need an accident. Every single facility in the nuclear fuel chain puts this stuff out. Now, we say, well, you can't see radiation, but you can see radiation's harm. We've seen it a number of times. This is very high doses of radiation burn, but you can see it with a microscope. These are abnormal chromosomes. This is tissue in the lung that's being damaged by alpha particles. This is cell membranes that have been destroyed and more abnormal chromosomes. This is schematic drawing projection of several different types of damage to DNA, including the double strand that is so hard to fix and results in so many problems. We've heard it. I'm going to say it again. No safe dose. And furthermore, it only takes a single emission from a single radioactive nucleus and that hitting a single cell to have the potential for a fatal cancer. A dose so small you cannot measure it can kill somebody. Does it do it every time? Of course not. We have incredible repair mechanisms. We live in a diverse series of events, but yes. One can equal none. It's not a folk song. EPA standards say there's no safe dose. NRC bases Part 20 and ALARA on no safe dose. NAS reports from year 1 through 7 affirm no safe dose. And most of all, we've seen the data. We've seen it. So if we start with a standard man, that little green round place, first, the medical community was protecting itself. Then the health physicist who was Carl Morgan standing here 12 years ago who said, we are all health physicists if we are concerned about radiation. They were sending military and paramilitary into very defined places in the Manhattan Project, into radiological zones that were small. Those standards were written for that purpose, and now they are being generalized to everybody, everywhere, all the time. And I need to draw to your attention, not that upper circle that looks so fascinating, the lower circle. The lower circle is where we see that in 100 years, we have increased the radiological experience of our species by 25%. 100 years ago, we didn't have industrial nuclear facilities. So that's why I can say that. 25%. Think of other environmental parameters going up like that. Now, I'm not saying that this represents reality. It's total fiction as to who's getting what. But still, collectively, our institutions are telling us that we've done that. Here is the picture of how it travels through our environment, and it's an honest picture because it shows the man, the standard man. And I just am bringing Rosalie in because it was about 4 years ago that I started getting questions in my public talks about radiation impacting women disproportionately. And I called Rosalie because I couldn't find anything about this, and I was kind of embarrassed. I was 18 years into this work, and I'd never heard this, and where did it come from? And it was Rosalie who said, well, look at this. Well, that was out of print. I called her back. She said, go into Beer 7. It's not in the text. You'll have to look at the numbers. It's in the numbers. And so I did my own independent analysis of the famous report, and I think Steve Wynn gave us very strong cautionary words today that this report is based largely on the Hiroshima Nagasaki A-bomb survivors. It's largely that lifespan study that he says is deficient in so many ways. It calls to question many things. But I want to point out is we're not talking only about breast cancer. When I talk about women and cancer, everybody assumes I'm talking about breast cancer. It includes breast cancer, but it is the full range of cancers in which these tables show this result. Those are the lifespan ones. I want to acknowledge Dr. Arjun Makajani has an Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, and he has a campaign called Healthy from the Start that's based on that lifespan projection. But I spent a lot of time with this lifetime attributable risk table, and this is the one that talks about the adults. And I wrote this paper and published it in October 2011 and took it around to all the agencies and was amazed to find that at ICRP I had applause from the audience when I gave a five-minute version of the paper. And they are actually beginning to work on this, oh, by the way. So real people, my son, my sweetheart, me, a little girl who's gone, and her friend, two guys, three girls, that's the ratio overall. Two guys get cancer, three girls. Two guys die of cancer, three girls. So why isn't it in the text of the report? Maybe it doesn't come up statistically. Well, Arjun Makajani says it does. Maybe there weren't enough women involved. I don't know. But the generalizations about radiation are based on men. And when we take those assumptions solely, we have an underestimate of harm for women. And in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulations, that's about a 40% at least underestimation for the harm to women. And that means an overall underestimation of radiation harm since we're about half the population. So it could be dismissed, it could be just, oh well, we forgot about it, but we are talking about every single female on the planet and every source of ionizing radiation from what I can tell, because we really haven't looked, so why not cast the net that big? We need to look. And by the way, there are now beginning to be animal studies in which these findings are also supported. So I need to wrap up, but I want to mention that the first big agency to put out a real sort of, yeah, okay, females are more affected is this recent report from the World Health Organization. I think it's a deeply flawed report. I don't have time to critique it other than to point out the icons. The first icon below the words is clearly an earthquake. The next icon is clearly a tsunami. And the third icon is clearly a pressurized water reactor that was not at Fukushima. So take that as a sign that you cannot apply what is in this report to necessarily reflecting reality. But it's an important moment where the World Health Organization is saying that there is a difference between males and females. They're saying 70% higher risk of thyroid cancer for little girls exposed below the age of five in that 0 to 5 age group. So quickly, ionizing radiation comes from outside our body. I believe there's a huge difference when it comes inside our body, and the BIR-7 report only looks at external. This book, which we've been all talking about, Alexei Yablokov has been with us, does factor internal exposure. There's this famous picture showing that radiation goes to different parts of our body, but the real point I want to make is that once it's in there, there's zero distance to the point of exposure, so the doses are extremely high. And the other thing is that external beta goes in about a centimeter. External alpha bounces off. There's zero exposure. And so the difference between an alpha particle in the body and not in the body is basically infinite. But when they compare it to an X-ray, it's anywhere from 7 times more damaging to findings that are 1,000 times more damaging. So if you're inhaling and ingesting radioactivity, if there's alpha particles present, they're really not reflected in the BIR-7 report. So that's another piece that we need to factor in here. Okay, wrapping up, I want to just go to this last slide. Disproportionate harm from ionizing radiation to females raises many issues. All are worthy of engagement. There's medical questions, there's ethical questions, there's historical, occupational, political, legal, evolutionary, and policy and regulation. It's my belief that we need to protect first and study second, but when it comes to the study, there are a bunch of places we could start. Probably not with body mass, because 0 to 5 age group, boys and girls are about the same. But Rosalie thought maybe it's the percentage of reproductive tissue. Someone else said maybe it's the proportion of fatty tissue. Maybe there are metabolic differences. Maybe it's selection, which is long-term environmental. Maybe it's lifestyle, which is short-term environmental. Hard to factor that last one with the 0 to 5 age group, though. And then finally, there are animal studies that are supporting this. So protect first, study second, but as we study, this is an important question, and I do not know of any major program addressing it. Thank you.
That was Mary Olson, director of the Southeast Office of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Quite an interesting study. I've never heard anything about a gender bias in radiation information. Had you?
No, but I don't honestly look too often into radiation studies. I simply don't. I've read what's come my way on Fukushima and years ago on Three Mile and what I had to learn in school, but I don't go out of my way to find it, you know, so this is all an education for me.
I had gotten involved in nuclear power issues. I had been reading physics for a long time from when I was a child, interested in it. But when Three Mile Island came along, I had good fortune enough to have my time scheduled so that I could listen to the hearings. And I arranged to have an NRC health physicist from the Turkey Point office of the NRC come and lecture at the college. And it turned out that not only was he the NRC's health physicist responsible for Turkey Point, but he had also been the one called in to work Three Mile Island. So he gave a lot of really interesting information. And even in what he didn't say, there was as much information there as there was in what he actually said. So I've been tracking this for a long time. And it seems amazing to me that given our improved sensitivity to sexual issues, that this information is really not coming out until now. It's
you,
appalling.
Yes.
And now yeah. I want to play Ms. Olson's update on the Fukushima matter, and let me play that now.
Hello. My name is Mary Olson. I work for Nuclear Information and Resource Service, and I live in the southeastern United States as a field staff member of that national organization, www.nirs.org. And I wanted to include that website because on the day of the catastrophe, which was the day of the, I guess they backed down from 10.0 to 9.8 on the Richter scale, only one earthquake on Earth in recorded history exceeds what happened off the shore of Fukushima, which is in Chile, in the early 70s. I don't remember the exact date, but there, in modern times, this ranks as number two in terms of a seismic event. Off the Fukushima prefecture, where there are multiple nuclear power plant sites, all of which were impacted heavily by both the quake and the subsequent tsunami wave, which was enormous, 124-foot crest of that wave. I have not heard, even in conjecture, whether the rising tides of our planet due to climate change and warming of the oceans may have elevated that tsunami. I think that will be for later analysis, but I think, you know, it's not impossible to tie all of these issues together as being related. The reactors came online in 1970, the first ones, and it's been a source of a little bit of forgiveness, a little bit of understanding, a little bit of compassion nested into this horrible feeling of outrage that I have about this event. To remember that in 1970 I was a young college student and I took a class on radical theories. There were three radical theories presented. One was greenhouse gas climate impacts. One was major meteor, planeted type large object impacts, like what brought the dinosaurs down, we now understand. In 1970, those two were radical theories. And the third radical theory was continental drift. We didn't even have the words plate tectonics yet in the year that these nuclear power plants came online. So it helps me a little bit to be forgiving of the people who made these decisions to put nuclear power plants in this incredibly seismic zone, that it was a failure of reevaluation, that they didn't go back and reapply the new sciences to the old decisions and say, oh, golly gee, bad idea. The owners of the site have admitted that the earthquake damaged the reactors at Fukushima. There are six reactors there, but three of them had the fuel taken out. Two of them, more than a month before, the fuel was transferred to fuel pools, and they have actually made it relatively okay. There has been some problems, but as far as we know, that fuel is intact. That's Unit 6 and 5. Unit 4 had only been defueled the week before for, you know, they do maintenance and other operations. They take all the fuel out, put it in the pool. These particular reactors are GE Mark I, designed by General Electric, built primarily in conjunction with the Japanese in the post-reconstruction period of Japan under military control of the United States during the 20 years that it took to build those reactors. So there are six there. They were refueling number four. The very hot fuel was taken out just the week before. It was in the fuel pool. And these General Electric reactors have their fuel pool at five stories high in the air above the reactor vessel, which is this incredibly robust steel and concrete structure down below. So, shake, rattle, and roll, 10.0, 9.8, whatever it was, comes through. Enormous amount of plumbing in these facilities. You have to lay every little pipe and tube end to end you can cover from one coast of the United States to the other with how much plumbing is in these facilities. So you can imagine all that shaking and rattling, that pipes and other things. We now know that at least one of the containments and one of the fuel pools were cracked by the actual earthquake. So they were in trouble already. And then 20 minutes later, you know, a tsunami, first the sea recedes, and then it comes back in full force. It's very possible that they lost cooling during the recession of the sea, but we don't know that. That's conjecture. And when the tsunami hit, it took out the off-site power. Most people would think that a power plant can power itself, that there would be, you know, the ability for the power plant to run the pumps that cool it, to run the control room that the operators use. But that's not how these things are designed. They're designed to rely on power coming into the site from off, you know, the grid. So the tsunami brings the grid down. There is at every reactor site backup power so that you can supply energy to run those pumps and run the control room. But that's run by diesel generators. And the tsunami engulfs the diesel generators and pulls their pumps out to sea. So the site now has zero power, no offsite power and no backup power. Today is the quake and the tsunami. Nuclear Information and Resource Service started a log. So if you ever want to like read the story in sort of blog style of what happened on each day, Michael Marriott, who's the executive director, somebody I've worked with for 20 years now, undertook to sift through all the information. Initially, it was just a trickle of information, and pretty quickly it became this maelstrom of all these news reports and all these different TV things and this expert and that expert. And all this massive information was flowing out. And he sifted through that and sort of put together what was the sort of critical path information in his view. It's just one view, but it's useful, and it's a very strong record of what unfolded. And what basically unfolded is we now know that the containments of two of the reactors were breached. One of the fuel pools was cracked. The fuel in that pool was extremely hot because it had just been loaded out of the reactor core, so it was essentially a reactor core outside of containment from just 1 week earlier. So it was a very, very unprecedented situation. There have been a number of major reactor accidents. You've perhaps heard of Chernobyl, which was an explosion and fire in one unit. Three Mile Island was the melting of fuel in one unit that was far greater release than the government ever admitted to, but much smaller than this. There was a meltdown in Detroit that you probably never heard about at Fermi 1. There was a small meltdown in California and one on Long Island that you probably also never heard about, Santa Susana and at Brookhaven. In the 50s, there were massive accidents, one in Scotland where a reactor burned, a military commercial reactor, sort of hybrid there, burned, called Windscale. And in the same year, an enormous tank of radioactive waste that was liquid exploded in the former Soviet Union. And so it's been about every 10 years that there's been a catastrophe in the nuclear world. We skipped the 90s, and that's another story, but probably due to the preventive work of Union of Concerned Scientists and my organization, we managed to forestall one. But Fukushima is unprecedented. Four units in catastrophe. Conjecture now that the fuel is continuing to melt. That's not confirmed. But in any case, in units 1 and 2, the fuel has actually melted and dropped down into the bottom of containment. They're doing their best to keep liquid around it. Unit 3, there was a huge explosion. 1, 3, and 4 all exploded, but 3 was much larger explosion. If you look at the high-resolution photographs, little drones have been sent over by, it's called Cryptome, and they're posting these very high-resolution pictures, photographs that were taken from unpersoned aircraft flying over, taking photographs. And you can see that Unit 3 is absolutely decimated compared to 1 and 4. Half of the fuel pool, third to half, looks to be gone. The top of the reactor vessel looks to be gone. It's still conjecture at this juncture, but that a chemical explosion at that site compressed the fuel in the fuel pool, and that compression made a critical mass that lasted only for a fraction of a second, but long enough to detonate an actual nuclear explosion in Unit 3. It's a theory, not yet confirmed, but there's a lot of data that supports it. And if you actually look at the photographs of Unit 3 as it exploded, there was a red fireball that was not part of the other two, that were simply gray kind of flashes of white light and gray explosions. And in Unit 3, the fireball followed by black that actually makes a little mushroom cloud suggests that there was a relatively small fission explosion. And the other concern about that unit is that there have been fragments of this fuel, the very same fuel that we a little while ago talked about as a potential scenario for an accident transporting what we call highly radioactive waste. The exact same fuel was distributed in a several mile radius. And that, the only event during Fukushima that could have possibly done that so far is the explosion of the fuel pool of unit number 3. So they're not talking about that. There's not differentiation when they talk about the different reactor units in the news, in the various reports. They skip over 3. They just don't mention it. It's as if it didn't happen. But I truly believe that that is the source of most of what we're calling the hot particles. And a friend of mine, Marco Catalfin, is doing monitoring using devices that are very much like human lungs in Tokyo. Tokyo's only about 120 miles away. The city's already very contaminated. It's millions and millions of people. I've forgotten what the exact population is, but it's all of our cities combined, practically, in terms of density of population. And that area is contaminated. So Marco has this thing going. He also is using air filters from automobiles to figure out what is traveling by air. And he says that they're getting like 10 hot particles a day in Tokyo, maybe a month ago, so I'm not sure what they're getting now, and 5 in Seattle. So this distribution of the hot particles that were part of these fuel rods is pretty important for people to know that these events are global. That it's, you know, clearly burning coal is creating global impact. Clearly the climate crisis is a global impact of burning coal. But Chernobyl has had global impact. Fukushima is having global impact. Dirty energy just plain has to be substituted. And when people say, oh, you're just anti-nuclear, I say, oh, no, I love nuclear power. I just like it 93 million miles away because the sun is really where this type of activity belongs. Otherwise, you know, we're stuck trying to, quote-unquote, control something that clearly is beyond our ability. Fukushima is being managed, but it continues to emit radioactivity because every time they put water in, the water either runs out, in which case it's ending up in the ocean or in tanks and then in the ocean, or it's boiling off, in which case radioactive steam is going daily into the air because every day they have to add more liquid.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's I'm going to stop Ms. Olson right there. I think you got the general gist of her comments. There's one more gentleman I want to bring on. He's a former TVA administrator. He's been involved in nuclear power since the Jimmy Carter administration, brings some very important insight. And Gwen, I think we really have to hear this. So let me go ahead and start this one now.
Sure.
And we'll give us just a couple minutes at the end. This is S. David Freeman, a former TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority administrator.
The atomic age started with the dropping of a bomb. Let's all hope and pray that it won't end with the same event. The reaction of the President of the United States, Harry Truman, was that we've got to make a blessing out of this awful thing. And that began America's greatest public guilt trip, which has continued on through the decades. I think if you were not alive at that time, as I was, you would not fully appreciate the enormity of the genuineness of the guilt trip. I mean, rather than debating whether we should or shouldn't have dropped the bomb, no one wanted to talk about that at the time, but we were deluged with the most vivid descriptions of how this awesome power, this almost godlike power, would be turned to the use of the benefit of mankind. I think it's useful to examine some of the words that were said. For example, the Robert Hutchins, who was the chancellor of the University of Chicago, where a lot of the Manhattan Project research was done, said the following: from atomic energy, heat will be so plentiful that it will even be used to melt snow as it falls. Very few individuals working a few hours a day at very easy tasks in the general atomic power plants will provide all the heat, light, and power required by the community, and those utilities will be so cheap in their costs to hardly be made to matter at all. The science writer, Scripps Howard, in 1945, said, all transportation forms will be freed at once from the limits now put upon them by the weight of present fuels. The privately owned airplane, now suitable only for cross-country hopping, will fly across the Atlantic. There would be no difficulty in building passenger and cargo airplanes of any desired size, and so on and so forth. They talked about filling the gasoline tank of your automobile rather than two times a week, once a year with a pellet of atomic energy the size of a vitamin pill. The day will be gone when nations will fight for oil. Large pellets will be used to turn the wheels of industry, and when they do, they will turn the era of atomic energy into the age of plenty. And it went on and on and on, and people believed it. It was a euphoric era. Truth of the matter, at the same time, David Lilienthal, the head of the AEC, had a report to Harry Truman that about the time the Russians put off their bomb, that we had no stockpile. So if you read all through David Lilienthal's journals when he was head of the AEC, there was never any discussion of civilian nuclear power. They were in the arms race, and they were talking about the hydrogen bomb, and it was all about armaments, and all this talk about this idyllic world was just talk, and the very bright scientists that built the bomb, they went back to their secure positions in universities mostly, and they didn't get down and dirty with things like pipes and pumps and things like that that had to be developed for a reactor. It took Hyman Rickover, actually, who was a hands-on Navy guy working with a private company that developed the Nautilus, which was the first actual civilian application of nuclear power. And you have to remember that a submarine is always in water, so there was no problem of cooling water, and there was no problem of cost. He made it right, but the costs were just astronomical, and so the application had no validity to the civilian nuclear power program, but it did give people a basis for thinking that perhaps all these dreams about nuclear power had some validity to it. So we went through this euphoric period that lasted through the 40s and into the 50s. And then we got into an era where the research wasn't producing anything. And frankly, the AEC people knew that they weren't anywhere near a civilian reactor, but they kept making all these grandiose promises in order to get money from the Congress to continue their weapons program, to be quite frank with you about it. And then events started happening. The Congress passed, the Price-Anderson Act in 1957, I think it was, which really was the beginning of the civilian nuclear power program. And they had some research reactors that didn't work out very well. No one paid much attention. But the big breakthrough was in 63, I think it was, when General Electric made a bid for the Oyster Creek nuclear power plant, and they bid at a price just under the price of coal. And, of course, the AEC and all these people hail this as the beginning of the commercialization of nuclear power. Well, it was a lost leader bid, if there ever was one. The GE had no idea what that nuclear power plant was going to cost. All they decided as a corporation, it was time to start selling them. They had a turnkey deal at a price that made it competitive. But that price was way under what turned out to be the cost, and it ushered in the era of the cost overrun. And so these plants were built or sold at a price that looked like it was competitive with coal, But let's just understand this. There has never been a nuclear power plant built that was cost competitive in this country or anywhere else. It just had never happened. This is a technology whose middle name is cost overrun. And its last name and first name, too, if you want to be really honest about it. And so all of a sudden, what looked like a dormant option that had just gotten a lot of lip service began to be quite the rage. And, I can remember personally that I was had left the Federal Power Commission. And I was in law practice in the mid-60s, and the General Electric Company came to my little law firm and asked us to help them figure out how to create a public power agency in New Jersey, because they wanted to build a half a dozen nuclear reactors right there on one site. Fortunately, the lawyers in GE said they'd be violating the antitrust laws and put a stop to it. But that was the mindset. It was so prevalent that a year later, the Peabody Coal Company came to our law firm and said that they were so afraid of nuclear power taking over the future, they didn't think the coal resources in the West would ever be developed, and they wanted to create public power agencies with low-interest money that could make the coal cheaper so they might have a chance of competing. Glenn Seaborg said, he didn't say it was probable, he said it was a certainty that nuclear power was going to be the wave of the future, and most people believed him. I personally found out how bad it was when I took over the Tennessee Valley Authority under Jimmy Carter in 76. I had found that TVA had stopped doing any maintenance work on its coal plants for years. They were going all nuclear. They had an armada, I would call it, of about 12 nuclear reactors that they had built, and they were just writing off their coal plants. We put $1 billion into putting scrubbers and pollution control equipment on those coal plants. Then if we hadn't, TVA would have blacked out, because there were times in the future when all of their nukes were down. But anyhow, the mindset in those years was that this was the wave of the future. But mind you, that there never was a single one of these nuclear power plants whose ultimate cost was anywhere near competitive with other sources of power. And the other thing to remember is that the old AEC had the dual role of promoting nuclear power. It's in the statute, as well as regulating it. And you know what took first place. It was the promotion. In fact, they suppressed all sorts of documents from their staff raising safety questions. So the issue of safety about nuclear power was not in the public domain as we went through this euphoric era in the 60s of just about everybody and their uncle ordering a nuclear power plant. At the same time, Glenn Seaborg, the head of the AEC, had gone to 60 different nations in the 50s. Remember the most famous speech of Dwight David Eisenhower as president was the Atoms for Peace speech he gave to the UN on December 8th, I think it was, 1953. And then as a result of that, we peddled the idea of the peaceful atom all over the world. And Seaborg was the main salesman. And I remember when the first time I went to Israel, and I asked them why in the name of heaven they were considering building an atomic power plant in the state of Israel. It would just be a Trojan horse. And I told them, and they said, well, Ben-Gurion told us that if you didn't have atomic energy, you weren't a modern nation. And that was really the mindset that we created. It was sold. It was made in America. It was sold by America all over the world. Now we face a new dilemma. Having sold the world,
we gone.
a better world is to come and tell you why. There's a better world is to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world is to come and tell you why. Better world is to come in, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world is to come in, don't you see?